Okay, good morning everyone. Thank you to coming to Michael's presentation on some actuarial issues with the valuation of injury schemes. Michael Playford has been a partner at PwC for 10 years. For most of that time, he has been the principal scheme actuary to WorkCover New South Wales, and he has also provided consulting advice in some shape or form for most workers' compensation schemes in Australia and New Zealand, working for both regulators as well as industry. He has provided advice related to reforms to public liability, medical indemnity, catastrophically injured, and victims' compensation and support. Michael remains as passionate as ever about the opportunities for actuaries to make a difference to the design, governance, and management of injury schemes. He is still learning new things all the time. His presentation today is on a variety of topics which he is curious about and where he believes more research is needed to better support actuaries operating in this field. So Michael tells me he's planning to be a little bit controversial today to challenge some established views. So with that in mind, he's hoping to speak for about 30 minutes to leave us plenty of time for questions and discussions at the end. So I'll hand over to you, Michael. Thank you.
Thanks for that, Peter. Thanks for coming along today, particularly the non-actuaries in the room. The title sounds pretty dry and boring. It's all about assumptions and parameters that actuaries use in their valuations and that. But it's stuff that actuaries, I think, get passionate about, and I get passionate. I put the ramble out the front because I can ramble about this stuff for hours, and I hope I can do it justice in the short time I've got. It's also a ramble because it's my first day back after 6 weeks' leave, and I haven't looked at my slides for 2 months, so I'm not going to be as eloquent as I should be. So again, I hope that I can do it justice. I want to have a bit of fun and, as Peter said, be a bit controversial. I think it's important that we're always challenging the status quo about how we approach our work, whatever our role is in this industry. And I think that's very important, particularly for the next generation of actuaries coming through behind, that you don't just accept the status quo, but are always thinking about, can we do it better? It's not necessarily that what we're doing now is wrong, but can we do better? And so that's why I'd like to try to get a discussion happening, not just today, but going forward, because I think some of the topics I'd like to cover today haven't been discussed broadly enough. And certainly when I'm discussing them with actuaries that I respect, we often can debate these topics for hours. And so I do think it is worthy for a much broader conversation throughout the profession than perhaps it has in the last few years. The Institute's always looking for research, and I think these are four topics that more research can be done on. I've probably bitten off more than I can chew by tackling all four in the short period today, so again, that's why it's going to be a bit of a ramble. I'll go back here. Now, you've got to have a caveat. And I'd like this caveat here because a good friend of mine whose opinion I respect is worried I'll make a bit of a fool of myself today. I prefer to think that I'm being brave by admitting that I don't have all the answers and by trying to demonstrate that I'm always wanting to learn. And I'm hoping that you'll approach that same way and be gentle and kind in the way you judge my presentation today. So first of all, I want to talk about risk-free discount rates. And this is not to say that I don't believe that risk-free discount rates are an appropriate basis for us in valuing liabilities for accident compensation schemes, but I'm not sure if we've got the proxy right, which is Commonwealth Government bonds, and I'll talk a bit about why that in the next few slides. I don't think there are sort of two philosophical camps you can fall in, which is either that you take a market consistent view where you should be using risk-free discount rates that can be backed by assets, Commonwealth Government securities, and looking at what the market value is at a point in time, or the alternative camp, which is around premium around liability stability. And I must say, for the valuation of accident compensation schemes, government accident compensation schemes, I do fall in that latter camp. I want to emphasise that for regulated private insurers, I think the accounting standards work very well and are appropriate the way they work currently, which take a market-consistent view. And I think it works well there because the mean duration of the liabilities for most private insurance products is short-term, and you can actually match the liabilities with Commonwealth Government securities, and that immunises the profit and solvency over time. And I think that's entirely appropriate given the importance of maintaining solvency and for private insurers. But for accident compensation schemes, their long duration of their liabilities mean you can't match them with the liabilities. And I've found in my experience that the volatility that changes in risk-free discount rates can have can lead to potentially an undesirable discussion in management and governance about what the true solvency position is and what the right management responses are. And I think that's really come to the fore over the last 5 to 7 years during the GFC. So, look, I've got four questions I ask myself around risk-free discount rates and our current approach. There's probably other questions that you could ask and answer. I didn't have time to think about them all, but these are four that I'm going to tackle today. The first is, what best meets the needs of financial reporting? And I think that's a good starting point. If you go back to the most fundamental sort of accounting standard, you know, even before you get to AASB 1023 or AAS 137, which are the main sort of accounting standards that are used for regulating accident compensation schemes, you've got this one the accountants called Framework for the Preparation and Presentation of Financial Statements. And it states in paragraph 43, the overriding consideration is how best to meet the economic decision-making needs of users. Okay? And I'm strongly of the view that the current approach for using Commonwealth Government securities for risk-free discount rates in accident compensation schemes doesn't best meet the economic needs of government, stakeholders that are trying to understand whether the schemes are operating efficiently and effectively. And that changes in the discount rates, which can lead to very material changes in liability, can actually confuse that decision-making. Now, a prime example of that was in 2012 in New South Wales, where there was this workers' compensation inquiry. And if you read a lot of the transcripts, the questions asking those inquiries, the submissions made, particularly, for example, I've got there quotes from the Australian Law Alliance and the Law Society of New South Wales, is around, is this deficit that the scheme had at that time purely an arbitrary deficit because discount rates have moved? And that had the potential to sidetrack the whole inquiry from the fundamental issue that the scheme probably wasn't meeting its key objectives of achieving an optimal return to work and social and health outcomes efficiently and effectively at the best cost that possibly could be used. And a lot of time as the actuary was spent in responding to questions about, well, was this all just an arbitrary deficit? Was the scheme really deteriorating for other reasons beyond just changes in the discount rates? So this really has got me thinking about, were these changes in the deficit, changes in the liability assessments, because risk-free discount rates have been moving over the last few years, really in the best interest of the economic decision makers that were using the accounts? And my conclusion was no. Now, this is also an issue for other long-tail liability schemes, superannuation. I've got an article there from the Sydney Morning Herald a couple of months ago around the problem superannuation funds have been having because, again, massive shifts in risk-free discount rates over the last few years. Other accident comp schemes, New Zealand Treasury has guidelines around how it asks all its long-tail insurance liabilities to be assessed to get consistency. Higher education contribution liabilities is probably another set of government liabilities that this is an issue for. So it's broader than just accident compensation schemes. My second question, which is probably the heart of my concerns, is around, are Commonwealth Government securities a good proxy for risk-free? I often have people throw at me that the accounting standards require you to use Commonwealth Government securities. And when you actually read the accounting standard, it says that it may be appropriate to use government bonds as a proxy for discount rates or as an appropriate starting point. And I think that word may is important. But the standard, the status quo in our industry is that everyone just uses Commonwealth Government securities. And I'd just like to challenge that. One of the reasons I like to challenge that is if you look at who holds Australian Commonwealth Government securities, the majority is owned by foreigners. And there's some very clear step changes in the value of Commonwealth Government securities, the yields on Commonwealth Government securities, based on what's been happening internationally over the last few years. So when the US government has a shutdown, or if Greece is about to default, or Spain, some big international event happens, you can see some very big shifts in yields on Australian government securities because of shifts in international capital moving in and out of Australia into these bonds. And it strikes me as a bit weird, if you like, that we're talking about valuing Australian liabilities, but we're backing them supposedly with Australian risk-free assets, but the yields on those supposed Australian risk-free assets are driven very much by international events. So are we truly matching Australian liabilities when the hypothetical risk-free assets and yields are being driven by international events? Now, a very unreliable source that I looked at was Wikipedia. And again, my close friend would say that you're crazy using that as your source. But I thought this was an interesting quote. This is around the appropriateness of using... I probably don't have time to read it all. The second half of it, since the risk-free rate should theoretically exclude any risk of default, this implies that the yields on foreign-owned government debt cannot be used as a basis for calculating the risk-free rate. Okay? So if the majority of Australian government bonds are owned by foreigners, and Wikipedia in all its wisdom saying, well, you shouldn't actually be using that because that includes currency risk, exchange risk, and hence a risk of default, you sort of scratch your head and say, well, these Commonwealth Government securities are a really good proxy for risk-free. I'd broaden that and just say it doesn't feel right to me that we're using a proxy for risk-free, which is subject to supply and demand. So on the supply side, at the start of the GFC, the Australian Government, in its wisdom, decided to start running very large deficits and issue a lot more Commonwealth Government securities, so the supply of government securities increased dramatically. So again, that would push yields down because the supply is up. And they did that because they were concerned about the risk to the Australian economy if they did not inject into the Australian economy to avoid a recession. So the Commonwealth Government made a clear decision based on concern about the broader risk to the economy. On the demand side, a lot of people started buying Commonwealth Government securities because of concern about the riskiness of other asset classes, and it just puzzles me that is it right that risk-free should be driven by the swings around supply and demand the way it's been shifting. Thank you. Good. Wikipedia goes on to say, if you get right down into it, it's been unable to locate any well-detailed discussion on the basis for the various conventions of estimating the risk-free rate through proxy rates, which appears to be a major hole in the theoretical literature. So if you get down to it, using Commonwealth Government securities around the world has become the proxy for risk-free discount rates, but there's actually really no theoretical basis for it. Now, this is all Wikipedia, but I'm just being there to get people thinking about, are we using the best proxy possible? Peter and colleagues over here last year at the last accident comp seminar did a paper around what do you do with for your yield curve out there beyond the range where there are observable government securities, and suggested an approach for coming up with the unconditional forward rate. I'm being a bit tongue in cheek here, but it strikes me a bit odd that we're coming up with a risk-free unconditional forward rate that has a thing called a risk premium in it. So that confuses me. Now, maybe that's just terminology. You could have a term premium in there, and that might be more useful. But again, I think we need to really think through, are we being scientific and evidence-based in how we're coming up with this? Another concern I've got with this approach, personally, is an over-parameterisation risk. The approach on the right has four components to it, each of which has to be estimated. And I think that's quite challenging to estimate all four of those things. So when you add them all up to get the unconditional rate of 5.8 at the bottom, how much uncertainty is around that because you've had to estimate four things. So I typically myself, I told you this is a bit of a ramble, would take a simpler approach, which is again, this two approaches, a market consistent versus a stability approach, this is probably a more stable approach, which probably derives from CAPM theory, where you look at alphas and betas. Now, one interpretation of alpha, if you can remember back to your university degree looking at CAPM, is alpha is the return you'd get if you invested in all asset classes, the entire economy. So if you can invest in the entire economy, the return you'd get is growth in the economy. So one interpretation of alpha, and there's many if you dig into CAPM theory, is that alpha is just the long-term real GDP growth. And then the nominal, then, unconditional forward rate would just be that plus an estimate of your long-term inflation rate. So there you've only got to estimate two things rather than four things. So that's one. I've come up with an example. The Reserve Bank targets about 2-3% for future inflation. A lot of people use 2.5 because that's in the middle. But if you actually look at its actual experience of achieving its target over the last 10 years, it's averaged out about 2.8. When you look at the intergenerational report, the Treasury estimates over the next 50 years the average real GDP growth rate about 2.7%. So add those up, you get about 2.5, pretty similar to the 5.8 that Peter and colleagues got in their previous paper. Last point there, I'm pretty pragmatic. I'm not going to get my nose out of joint about what range you shift from the observed yield curve to a long-term conditional. I think it's all very difficult. So I'm pretty pragmatic about whether you do it over a short range or a long range, or whether you take a gap approach or not. So that's all I'll say on that in the interest of time. Last thing is I'd like to talk about with risk-free discount rates is what represents a risk-free investment strategy, because that's sort of another sort of a fundamental approach you could take for thinking about what is an appropriate risk-free discount rate for accident comp schemes. So for private insurers, it sort of makes sense to me that a risk-free asset or investment strategy would be investing in Commonwealth Government securities, because that would match the liabilities and you can do that. To me, it doesn't make sense that an accident comp scheme would invest in Commonwealth Government securities as a risk-free investment strategy. And I say that not just because you can't get Commonwealth Government securities at the longer durations that you need, but also from a government perspective, the government's got a responsibility to try to optimise productivity in the economy and the allocation of capital in the economy. And it's actually, in my view, not necessarily an effective use of employers' capital to hold that in an accident compensation scheme's balance sheet, just invested in Commonwealth Government securities. If the return that's generated by an accident compensation scheme is only that you get on risk-free on Commonwealth Government securities, that's probably lower than what you get in other asset classes, which then requires employers to pay higher premiums, because that's sort of the fundamental equation up the top there, that if you have lower investment income, you need higher premiums to pay the right-hand side of the equation. And is it the best use of employers' money to be sitting in the WorkCover's balance sheet, because it's not going to generate as much investment return as it otherwise would, as opposed to them making decisions of how best to use that capital in their own businesses. So I probably haven't articulated that very well, but I think of it from a perspective of how is it the best way of making decisions about how capital should be employed in the economy, you wouldn't come to the conclusion that it's best employed by being invested in risk-free Commonwealth Government securities in an accident compensation scheme's balance sheet. Look, I won't go through that slide in the interest of time, but in summary, what I'm saying is I'm not convinced that Commonwealth Government securities are a good proxy in an accident compensation scheme context. I'm not convinced that a Commonwealth Government security investment strategy makes sense as a risk-free investment strategy for an accident compensation scheme. Maybe I'm a bit mad here, but one thing that gave me some comfort is the day I flew out of Sydney on my 6-week holiday, I was sitting in the airport and using my iPhone, and I came across an article by Reuters where the Financial Times the day before had published an article by Jens Weidmann, who happens to be the president of the German Reserve Bank, the Bundesbank, and is also on the European Central Bank's Governing Council, in which he's recently had an opinion piece published, in which he took aim at the treatment of sovereign exposures in existing and incoming regulatory frameworks. So I'm assuming he's talking about things like Basel III and so forth. The current regulation's assumption that government bonds are risk-free has been dismissed by recent experience, he wrote. The time is ripe to address the regulatory treatment of sovereign exposures. So I'm not the only one thinking that maybe we need to do a bit of a rethink about what we use as a proxy for risk-free, but that's enough on that. Some other things I wanted to have a bit of a ramble on is risk margins. Look, I think risk margins, the role of risk margins makes a lot of sense and is pretty self-evident for private insurers, where it's helped to improve the protection of claimants and the likelihood that their liabilities will be paid out and protect against the default of the insurer. But for a government accident comp scheme, it's okay for those schemes to run with a deficit. I mean, it might be laudable and an appropriate goal to aim to be fully funded, but it doesn't need to be. So what is the role of a risk margin in an accident compensation scheme? I would say it is a preferable way of storing capital in an accident comp scheme's balance sheet, because my experience is that once a scheme gets back to surplus, there's a lot of pressure to either reduce premium rates or improve benefits, both of which are very hard to undo if the good recent experiences proves to be transitory. So holding some capital as a risk margin as a buffer in the balance sheet makes a lot of sense to me. But the risk margin in the balance sheet typically isn't allowed to vary from one valuation to another. So my concern there is that when things go bad, the risk margin increases, which actually creates a bit more of a death spiral. And so an example of that, again, during the GFC, is that when risk-free discount rates reduced, the present value of the outstanding claims liability went up, which is then exacerbated by the risk margin held on top of the net central estimate going up, which further showed the published solvency position of schemes deteriorating, which led to quite a debate in a number of schemes around whether premium rates should go up. And I don't know if that was necessarily the right debate, because just at that time, employers probably didn't need to have increased premiums when they were struggling to maintain their businesses, and taking higher premiums off employers may have actually contributed to a worsening in the economic environment in Australia. So, again, what was the right response there? Fortunately, I don't think any schemes actually increased premium rates during the GFC, but it shows the potential that the debate can get confused both by the approach we take to risk-free discount rates and how we utilise risk margins in schemes generally. 20 minutes. Jeez, I am rambling. Is it appropriate for government accident comp schemes to meet APRA regulatory standards? My view is no. Most schemes seem to be aspiring towards about a 75% probably of adequacy for their risk margins. That seems about right to me. One observation I'd make is many boards that I've come in contact with seem to think that by having a 75% probably of adequacy in their risk margin, they're complying with APRA standards, and don't get it that APRA has a whole lot of other capital loadings on private insurers, insurance margins, asset margins, concentration risk margins, operational risk margins. And in fact, if you allowed for all those other capital loadings, APRA would require you probably double, if not more, the capital required to be held by accident comp schemes, which isn't, in my view, a good use of the capital of employers, which could be more productively employed in their own businesses. So that's that. I'd like to... last comments there. With accident comp schemes, they're really stable. So bootstrapping approaches, statistical approaches, looking at data might work well in private insurers or short tail classes. I don't think they work particularly well for coming up with risk margins in accident comp schemes. I do like forward-looking approaches because I actually consider the risks facing schemes, but it's very hard to quantify. I've got an example there from the 2012 reforms where when the reforms happened, a number of people actually said to me, well, you'll be increasing the risk margin now because of reform uncertainty. But in fact, the whole point of the reforms was to reduce uncertainty in the scheme by tackling known deteriorating trends and redesigning the scheme so it would be more stable into the future. And so I actually argued, well, maybe risk margins could come down because of the reforms rather than go up because of the reforms. Chris Latham and Winley Toe last year had a go at risk margins and saying, are we over-engineering them? I have some sympathy with that point of view. Last two points that I'll ramble through very quickly is a small number of catastrophic claims can account for a large part of the liability of these schemes. And so a lot of effort should be made in the valuation of these schemes, of these claims. So an example, a scheme I know well, the New South Wales Work Cover Scheme, has about 140 claims that account for over 10% of the entire liability of that scheme. Should we allow for mortality improvement for those catastrophic claims? Although it's generally accepted that mortality improvement's been going on in the general population over the last 100 years, there's not a lot of evidence that you can dig up literature around. And I've got a quote there from another actuary that I asked, who said there's not a lot of literature around this. And that's hard then of deciding, well, what sort of mortality improvement you should allow for. Secondly, how do you allow for morbidity impairment on these catastrophic claims? So if there's not much literature around mortality... mortality improvement, there's even less literature around mortality impairment. And what literature there is mainly around spinal cord injuries. It's a lot harder to categorise brain injuries, and hence what the right mortality impairment loading should be for brain injuries. Okay, and then in some workers' compensation schemes, quite a sizeable proportion, less so in CDP schemes, but in workers' comp schemes, perhaps a quarter of catastrophic claims are neither brain injury or spinal cord injury. They might be very severe burns or multiple amputations or crushing injuries and that, where there's even less of an evidence base. The next point is, well, if you're going to allow for improvements in mortality, should you allow for improvements in morbidity? And again, there's even less evidence around that. So a good example would be, my understanding is that historically a major source of mortality for spinal cord injuries was to do with urinary tract infections. And that's no longer the case because of improvements in treatment of urinary tract infections over recent years. But by the same token, that improvement in the treatment of urinary tract infections would have improved the morbidity experience of people with spinal cord injuries dramatically, a lot less time in hospital and so forth. But how do you allow for that? The last point is, how do you allow for superimposed inflation? Should superimposed inflation for these claims go up or down as people age? And again, there's very little literature around that. So I guess my points I'd like to make there is, you've got sort of four factors there, each of which have very little evidence to help you quantify them, and they have very different directional impacts on the liability. Is it right or wrong to allow for one of them and not the other three? Are these issues better allowed for in risk margins? I don't know. I'd be interested in people's view. This, to me, is a prime candidate for some more evidence to be collected from schemes, if schemes have an interest in it, because the liability associated with these claims is so significant. I know that David Gifford and others are presenting a paper from the TAC experience on this, I think, later today, and so I'm going to be very interested in attending that. My last ramble is around superimposed inflation, where I think there is a tendency by actuaries to be a bit conservative around superimposed inflation. I've seen a number of schemes which I've reviewed over recent years where there's been central estimate superimposed inflation assumptions of 3 or 5% per annum that just go on forever in the valuations. And I'm not sure there's a lot of evidence that we're in an environment where superimposed inflation is happening or is likely to happen over the mean duration of the liabilities currently. So over the next 3 to 4 years, will you see superimposed inflation levels? That would give you a reason to believe that you should be allowing a central estimate assumption of 3 or 5% in your valuation. Look, I'd also make the point that a major source of superimposed inflation in accident compensation schemes is around medical costs, and it's generally accepted that medical costs are increasing more than general inflation in the economy. But when you look at how accident compensation schemes differ from the general economy, big differences are ageing is not an issue for accident compensation schemes, in that you're only dealing with the originating injury. You're not dealing with diseases related to ageing like cancers, and it's cancers and things like that that have a lot of the expensive medical treatments that are driving up overall medical costs. So I'm not convinced that medical Superimposed inflation is as big a risk as what you see in the general economy, but I know there's a lot of debate around that, and I'd be interested in people's points of view. I guess the key point down the bottom there is superimposed inflation assumptions can materially change the liability. So if you have a mean duration of your liabilities of 4 years and you assume 5% superimposed inflation, your central estimate liability is going to be 20% higher than what it otherwise would be if you hadn't included a superimposed inflation allowance at all. And I often don't feel like it's very well articulated why actuaries are putting in the superimposed inflation allowance that they are putting in their valuations. Not so much for the government schemes, but when I look at private sector insurer valuations in this area, and I just think that a bit more thought should be given to making sure it's articulated the evidence or the logic for why it's being included. So look, that's a ramble. I'm sure I haven't done it justice given the time frame, but I've done it very much because I think these are issues that are worthy of discussion and debate, not just in the remaining time we've got here, but over coming months and years in the profession. I do think there are areas where a lot more research could be done by the Institute so we have a much stronger basis for making decisions in each of these areas. Thank you for bearing with me, and I'll end it there so that we've got some time for... I know there's a number of people who passionately would like to get up and have put their point of view, and I'd like to give them that opportunity. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, Michael. We do have 10 minutes for questions and discussion, so I invite you to come up to the microphone and ask your questions to Michael. If you please state your name and your organisation when you ask your question, please. Thanks.
Go on, Bruce.
Hi, Bruce Watson. Michael, it might have happened while you were away on your holiday, but the government announced that climate policy is no longer going to be based on the independent commission. It's going to be based on Wikipedia. So you haven't made a fool of yourself today. You're in good company. Could I ask you about an assumption you didn't talk about? In compensation schemes, particularly workers' comp, the thing that's probably the most critical assumption that can swing liabilities around would be the long-term continuous rates for weekly benefits, particularly for schemes like ours, which are, have that sort of feature. You've got any kind of thoughts? This is a really unfair question. You've just come back from holidays. Have you got any thoughts about the state of play and any sort of research or really good practice about those assumptions?
Yeah, absolutely. It's probably the key assumption. As most people in the room would probably know, and many of these schemes haven't been around for long enough to have actual observed experience right out there in the tail. I think there has been a lot of advances in what's best practice in this area over recent years, actually looking at things like the age profile of the claimants in the tail and modelling their exact age to retirement, because as you get out there in the longer tail, the decrement for people retiring dominates. And doing that more sophisticatedly than was in the past, looking at breaking up the sort of overall continuance rate into sort of increments and decrements and the different decrements and modelling them individually to try to get more insight into what's going to drive the overall continuance rate right out there in the tail. I think there has been advances in more sophistication across schemes in that over the last, I think, 5 to 10 years. Very sensitive though, and very small changes can make a difference. And I think you've got to be very careful that you don't overreact to short-term experience in making those assumptions, because you are talking about what typical continuance right be might be over the next, you know, after 40 years, and a short-term burst of good experience or poor experience can lead to massive changes in the liability if you overreact to that. And again, that's not helpful in terms of the governance of these schemes. Come on, Richard.
Thanks, Michael. Richard Brooks from Taylor Fry speaking. That was a very interesting presentation. I've got some comments. I certainly won't make them all. As Michael's alluded to, Michael and I have jousted on some of these issues for a long time, over long email conversations and so forth, and this is probably not the place to continue that in detail. There are a fair number of areas where we agree, and I think Michael's comments on both on superimposed inflation and particularly risk margins, I have some sympathy with. I think that the science applied to risk margins is in a lot of ways misplaced. I think most of risk margins is in respect of environmental and systemic changes, and those things are not easily amenable to the quantitative techniques that we use to try and assess the risk margins. So I'm a bit of a believer in either them not being there at all, or at least a relatively simple approach being taken to them. I think there's even less argument for risk margin in a government accident compensation scheme. I can see their place perhaps in private insurers, although I think they should be in capital, but I certainly don't see the case for them in the sorts of cases that Michael's been talking about. Where we do have some disagreement, and talk for a long time about this, but I'm going to try and make it brief, is in the area of discounting and risk-free rates. And I think lots of things. I think that the distinction that's been drawn between private insurers and government-owned compensation schemes is probably not a hard and fast distinction. In fact, it may not even be a distinction at all. I'm not sure that the value of a liability should depend upon who owns it. I think value of a liability is pretty much a universal concept. And I also think that the value of a liability should bear a fairly strong relationship to the value of the closest matching asset that you can get. And this conversation might well get onto issues such as inflation, but that wasn't raised earlier on. And if we leave inflation to one side, it seems to me that the answer for discounting and valuing liabilities, whether they be short or long term, is pretty simple. The answer is that you ought to take a value of the liability which is consistent with a matching asset on the other side of the balance sheet, and that pretty much is the value of an asset which has minimal default risk, and that seems to me to be government bonds. I also think that the question about the term of the liability, although I understand that the discounted mean term of liabilities for these sorts of schemes is probably 6, 7, or 8 years, there are government bonds out of that duration. So a large part of the liability for the sorts of schemes we're talking about is capable of being matched in the market by assets of equivalent duration. So it's nice that I could go on about this for some time. I'm a simple man. I think the answer to this is simple. You want a valuation discount rate which is consistent with the matching assets, which leads to the minimum possible volatility in the overall balance sheet when you take into account assets and liabilities together. And I think if we set inflation to one side, which accept is difficult to do, then the answer to that is the government proxy, the government bond yield rate and yield curve. Thanks.
Well, Michael, I have a question.
Yeah.
You put up a proposal for a long-term expected short-term interest rate, I think, with your... is it your intention that rate is used for discounting liabilities at all durations or just in the long term beyond the yield curve?
I think given the status quo and you know the way the accounting standards are at the moment, it really, in practice, I'm suggesting it only for longer durations beyond the observable yield curve. If you were extreme and said, look, Commonwealth Government securities aren't a good proxy, then arguably you should apply it across all durations as an alpha.
Jonathan Nichols, ACC New Zealand, government-owned scheme. Question about risk margins. Taking away the idea of whether it's over-engineered or not and just looking at whether a government-owned scheme should have it or not, what is your thoughts on the view that if you were to look at the value on the balance sheet, you've got the assets at market value and the liabilities, you know, perhaps they should be at market value so that you're your notional asset liability and net equity is, if the government wanted to exit, sell off all the assets at market value, sell the liabilities, and you're not going to sell them at 50%. You're going to need something to get it up to be able to sell it, and therefore that by adding a risk margin, you're able to present a view of what the scheme is worth if you were to sell it off.
Look, none of this is simple. I mean, that's another very good way of tackling it. I don't think any of them are right or wrong. It is a very logical thing. The reality is there isn't a ready market for selling off government accident comp liabilities. It doesn't happen very often. I think of it from the alternative approach of it's the responsibility of government to use the capital of the economy optimally. And is it optimal for that capital to be stored in an accident compensation scheme's balance sheet as opposed to being productively employed by employers in their own businesses in the economy? You know, there's just different ways of looking at it, and I'm not sure what the answer is. That's why I'm talking about it today, to say I don't have all the answers.
Superimposed inflation. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it's kind of like used as an extra buffer for anything that you can't explain. or that you can explain but doesn't get factored into your model well. So, for example, in workers' comp, medical and rehab expenses, as you said, often tend to be greater than the wage inflation rate, therefore you put a sign there. What about with sort of, I guess, sort of common law type benefits where they can be quite wildly different to what you expect, and if you do see an increase over a period of time without any real explanation, how do you allow the superimposed in terms of obviously how long that should go for, and do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, it's all very difficult, but if you're that unsure, is it more appropriate that it should be dealt with via the risk margin as opposed to the net central estimate? I just question that people do need to think about. You know, you've sort of saying that it's used as a bit of a catch-all for everything that's unexplained and unknowable and whatever. Well, is that truly what the central estimate is about? And have you got the right quantum if you're allowing for it at such high levels in your central estimate if it's so uncertain and unsure?
Sorry.
Len?
I have no idea what I'm saying, but...
That's all right, I don't either.
If I could ask, because I don't really understand the history of all this, but I vaguely think it all evolved out of the fear of the risk of an insurer failing. Mm-hmm. And that over time we use it for more and more purposes. If that is the fundamental purpose of it at the start, what's the implications for how we're looking at it now?
Mm. And I think that's this thing about for accident comp schemes, government-owned, it's okay for them to be in deficit. I mean, there's many schemes in Australia, government schemes, New South Wales is a good example I'm familiar with, which for the majority of its existence, it's been not fully funded. So what is the right role of a risk margin in that situation as opposed for a private insurer where it's very clear that it's about providing improved security for claimants, that their entitlements will get paid out?
Okay, unfortunately we've run out of time, but if you could all join with me and thank Michael for a very interesting and thoughtful question.